Chapter 77. A rooster crowed loudly, and the sun broke brilliantly over the Judean hills. Shafts of sunlight knifed into the Kiryat Arba apartment. The windows were open, and the morning breeze played a soft rattle on the blinds. Jack and Marcy were sitting on the living room couch when Liam entered the room. Kayla was in the kitchen.
"Did anyone sleep?"
Marcy asked. Liam raised his hand.
"Yonit should be here any minute," Kayla said, staring into an empty refrigerator.
"I hope she brings breakfast."
"I hope she brings you a Smith & Wesson 40 caliber with extra clips," Liam muttered.
Kayla answered a knock on the door. Yonit entered the apartment with two young men, smartly dressed in olive IDF uniforms, pants bloused into black boots, red berets, their arms full of paper bags and packages. Yonit handed a nurse's folded white uniform, shirt, jacket, and trousers to Kayla.
"Size 6?
Kayla nodded and left the room to put it on. Yonit laid a silver metal briefcase on the coffee table.
"Here's your booby-trapped case. Combination on the left is 1234, and on the right, 4321.
She clicked it open. Inside were stacks of 500 euro bills, neatly bound. On top of the currency was a red rod, 8 inches long, with wires protruding from each end.
"This is a replica of a small explosive, inoperative, of course, consistent with our threat that the case was rigged. It may also serve as a visual deterrent if all else fails, maybe to buy you a few seconds of distraction."
"Why isn't it real?"
Marcy said.
"Couldn't Jack have a need for an explosive?"
"If things deteriorate to the stage where he'd need an explosive device, well, it would probably result in getting Jack killed or providing an extra weapon for Al-Zahani. In the exchange, if Jack hands the case to Al-Zahani, well, we prefer that weapons, if any, be in the hands of Kayla and Liam."
"If any? What does that mean?"
Marcy said. Yonit shrugged.
"Just a figure of speech."
"It means she thinks that we will enter the house unarmed," Liam said.
"She thinks they won't allow me to approach the house with my gun, and she's less than confident of my ability to grab the guns hidden in the van. Am I right, Colonel?"
Yonit turned and walked to the kitchenette.
"Just a figure of speech."
"Did one of you bring breakfast?" Liam asked. "Or should we just take a 500 euro bill to the corner deli for some bacon and eggs?"
"You wouldn't get any bacon."
Yonit took a paper bag from one of the soldiers and set it on the counter.
"Here's some fruit, juice, and breakfast rolls."
Yonit cleared the coffee table and unrolled the schematic of the compound. Liam and Kayla hovered over the drawing.
"We'll have sharpshooters here, here, and here, but we're hoping for a quick grab without the need to fire. There's typically one guard, maybe two at the front gate. Others patrol the perimeter. We've allowed for the possibility that they may increase the number for your arrival. You know the routine at the gate. We've been over it before. We'll be watching and listening. If anything goes amiss, we'll move in. If it all follows the plan, we intend to neutralize the perimeter guards after they open the gates and let you in. We'll have troop transports here and here, around the corner and out of sight. They'll enter the compound after you've gone inside the home."
"What if the gate closes after we've driven inside?" Liam said.
"I doubt they'd leave it open."
"What if you can't get in the gate?"
"The wall is only 8 feet high. We can manage it."
Yonit took a small button from a pouch.
"This is your microphone," she said to Liam. "It replaces the button on your jeans."
She smiled.
"I need to put it on. You'll have to take your pants off."
"You're putting the mic on my pants?"
"When you arrive at the gate, we expect a thorough search.
They'll pat you down. They may ask you to take off your shoes. They may ask you to take off your shirt. They may even wand you, but we don't think they'll ask you to take off your pants. But even if they do, the mic is pretty much undetectable. It's very sensitive, won't set off the wand, broadcasts half a mile, and will pick up everything in the room. Now, let me have your pants."
"I have to take off my pants."
Yonit grinned.
"Unless you want me working in that neighborhood with a sharp tool.
Now, will you stop being such a baby?"
Liam stepped out of his pants, stood on his boxers, and frowned at the general chuckling in the room. When Yonit had finished, Liam examined the brass button on his jeans and pulled them up.
"Very cool. Looks good. Can't tell the mic from the original button.
Is it working, picking up the sound?" One of the soldiers with earbuds nodded.
"It's on a dedicated frequency," Yonit said.
No one but the IDF will hear it. Bear in mind, it's not only for your protection, but ours as well. Should things break down inside, it's there for the safety of my soldiers. If you see Al-Zahani move to trigger explosives in the outbuilding, you have to alert us. We don't know how he's got it wired, but if he gives you any reason to think he's going to blow the building, let us know. We'll be listening.
For the next 2 hours, the group made small talk, fidgeted, reviewed the protocols, paced the room, stared out the windows, and watched the clock. The movement of the minute hand was imperceptible. Liam had hesitated all morning, but finally took out his cell phone and made the call.
Hey, Kat. Liam, are you all right?
I'm fine. We're about to head over to Hebron to pick up Sophie.
Oh, hell, Liam, I wish you weren't going.
I know, but it'll be a simple little operation. I don't have to do much. The Israeli army's gonna handle the heavy stuff.
You're such a liar.
No, really, Kat, I just called to say hello.
Liam.
Kat, I love you very much.
I know. I love you more.
Kat, I gotta go.
Liam, wait.
Can't. Gotta go.
Call me the moment you're done. I'm going to sit by the phone.
Goodbye, sweetheart. Marcy sat on the couch with Jack, her arm around his shoulders. She smoothed his hair.
Jack, what can I say?
Don't say anything. Arif's a bastard, but he loves Sophie. He will not harm her or put her into danger, no matter what happens. It's a good plan. When this is over, the IDF will bring her out.
You must promise me that you'll take Sophie to Deborah. Jack, you'll take her.
No, Marcy, promise me. No matter what happens to me, you must make sure she gets to Deb.
Jack, promise me. I promise.
Tell her that I never left her. Tell her that I never stopped loving her, not one second. Tell her...
Jack, stop. She knows.
He nodded and took a picture out of his wallet. This picture of Alina. Show it to her. Give it to her. And remind her that her mother loved her very much. Marcy bent over and hugged him tightly. Her lips quivered and tears ran down her cheeks.
Don't do anything stupid. Let Liam and Kayla handle it. Just go get Sophie and come back.
Then Marcy stood up and threw her arms around Liam's neck. She tried to speak. Her voice caught in her throat, and she put her head against his chest.
We'll bring him back,
Liam said gently.
Sophie, too.
He gently patted her head.
Don't worry, we'll be back.
Yonit looked at her watch. 11:30.
It's time.
Chapter 78. Liam guided Jack out to the van, slid the door to the side, and paused. In the momentary interlude, he stood to take in the setting. To his right lay the rolling countryside, a palette of earthy colors, peaceful, pastoral, dry and thirsty. To his left sat tens of thousands of white stone buildings on the Hebron Hills, all box-like, all with dark windows that looked like hollow eyes. What was it Kayla had said? A spawning ground for terrorists? He rolled the wheelchair onto the platform, pushed the controls, and engaged the lift to raise it into the van. As he did so, the hidden panel released and opened just enough to permit access to the two handguns. Liam checked to see that the guns were in place, shut the panel, and nodded to Yonit.
Are we set?
She said.
He nodded.
Okay, follow me.
Kayla slid into the driver's seat, smiled nervously at Liam, and started the van. She followed Yonit's blue BMW down the hill, through the checkpoint, and along the bumpy streets of the ancient city of Hebron. Along the route, on the walls of shuttered buildings, graffiti proclaimed, "Go dance on your own streets, end the siege in Gaza, and reclaim Hebron." They drove slowly, inconspicuously, bypassing the marketplace and heading north. Soon Kayla recognized Al-Zahani's neighborhood, and his walled compound came into view. They watched Yonit drive past the property and turn around the next corner. No soldiers were in sight.
"Everyone ready?" Kayla said.
She slowed the van, took a deep breath, and turned into Al-Zahani's driveway.
Three men stood in front of two black metal gates 8 feet high and 10 feet across. They watched the van approach, took a last drag on their cigarettes, and ground them out on the pavement. One guard, in a weathered tan cargo jacket and checkered keffiyeh, grabbed his assault rifle, stepped away from the gate, and approached the driver's window.
"Come out of the truck," he said in Arabic. "We're here to see Dr. Al-Zahani," Kayla said. "We have an appointment. Please let us through."
"I said, come out of the truck," he said more forcefully. Liam felt for the pistol tucked into his belt. Kayla didn't miss a beat. "And I said we're here to see the doctor. You don't give me orders. I don't know who you are."
The second guard walked to the passenger door and knocked hard with the butt of his rifle. Liam fingered his weapon.
"I hope you're listening, Yunit," he said quietly.
"We work for Dr. Al-Zahani," said the guard to Kayla. "Then call for Dr. Al-Zahani."
Kayla pointed to the bronze keypad next to the gate.
"He'll confirm our appointment. It's a business meeting."
"We know what it is. Do you take us for fools?"
"I don't take you for anything. You don't interest me at all. Unless you let us in, I'm going to drive away."
With that last comment, the three guards leveled their rifles at the windows of the van.
"You're not going anywhere. Get out of the truck, now!"
Kayla sat back, folded her arms across her chest, and stuck out her chin.
"Are you crazy?"
Jack said softly.
"They're going to fire at us."
"I don't think so," Kayla said. "You have a briefcase on your lap with 4 million euros, and they don't know the combination. Hang tight."
"Get out!"
they screamed, and hammered on the doors with their rifle butts. Amid the confrontation, the mechanized gates parted and slowly opened inward to reveal a man standing in the middle of the driveway. Dressed in cream cotton slacks, a beige collared shirt worn outside his trousers, and tan suede loafers, he stood tall in the afternoon breeze.
"Al-Zahani," Jack said.
The doctor walked toward the van and waved his guards away with a flick of his hand.
"Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Hebron," he said to Kayla through the open window. "I assume you are the nurse."
"Wa alaikum salam, yes, I am. This gentleman is Mr. Taggart, who's negotiated this meeting, and I'm sure you recognize Mr. Summers."
"Hello, Jack,"
Al-Zahani said in English.
"I'm sorry to see you in a wheelchair. I wish you a speedy recovery."
Jack clenched his teeth. He nodded.
"May I ask that you all step out of the van, please?"
Al-Zahani said.
"I'm sure you understand the need for caution these days.
In this violent region, my home is a place of peace. There are no weapons of any sort inside, and we do not permit any weapons beyond this portal. So if you've brought a weapon, would you please hand it to my security personnel to be returned to you when you leave?"
Kayla stepped down out of the driver's seat, and Liam jumped down from the passenger seat. "As you know, Dr. Al-Zahani, I'm a private investigator licensed to carry a gun," Liam said. "I don't go anywhere without it, and that goes double in the Palestinian territories. I have a gun, and I don't intend to give it to your men."
"In that case, I'm afraid you will not be allowed into my home. You'll have to wait here."
"Jack's not going in without me."
"Then perhaps our meeting is over."
"Look," Liam said, "we did our part. We brought the money. You don't want us to leave with the money, do you?"
"Oh, of course not. That money is earmarked for the schools of Hebron. $5 million will go a long way to build new schools for our children, and it would be a shame for the children to lose out on that donation. But my home is a weapon-free zone, and you must respect my wishes."
"So unless I give you my gun, you'll tell us to drive away?"
"And wish you all a bon voyage."
Al-Zahani smiled.
"Give him the gun, Liam," Kayla said.
"Kayla, give him the gun."
Liam frowned at Kayla. He reached around, lifted his pistol from his belt, and handed it to the guard. "And the nurse who speaks such fine Arabic," Al-Zahani said with a tinge of irony in his tone. "May I ask which hospital employs you?"
"I'm in a private practice."
"Yes, I'm sure you are.
Do you have a weapon?"
"I do not." Al-Zahani motioned for the third guard, who walked over with a metal detector wand.
"It's not that I don't trust you, but one can never be too careful."
The guard waved the wand over Kayla and then Liam. It did not beep. Al-Zahani looked through the open door into the back seat.
"Do you have any weapons, Jack?"
"No." That's good enough for me.
Then to Liam and Caleb, the doctor said, Would you follow me, please?
He turned and walked through the gate into the compound. Kayla started to head back to the driver's seat, but Al-Zahani said, Oh, don't bother. My men will bring the van into the yard.
Liam and Kayla followed Al-Zahani on foot up the driveway and toward the front door. 100 yards to his left, Liam spied the long, stone, one-story outbuilding. No guards were visible at the doorway. He stopped to wait for the van to catch up.
Again, Mr. Taggart, my men will be happy to assist Jack from the van,
Al-Zahani said. The controls on this rental vehicle are tricky, Liam said. It's better that I help Jack.
I'm sure we can handle it.
The guard in the checkered keffiyeh stood by the van door waiting for Jack to engage the lift. Jack pushed the buttons on his control pad a few times and finally shouted, Liam, my controls aren't working again. You'll have to use the buttons on the door panel. Liam shrugged and looked at Al-Zahani. I told you.
Yusuf, the doctor said to the man in the checkered keffiyeh. Use the controls on the door panel.
Yusuf tried several times unsuccessfully to engage the lift. He pulled hard on the lift mechanism and on the back of the passenger seat. He yanked. He pushed. He slammed his fist on the button pad and even kicked at the platform. Liam glanced nervously at Kayla. After several tries, the guard shrugged and opened his arms.
As I told you, Liam said, and walked over to the van.
He leaned forward into the passenger compartment, positioning his jacket and body to block the view of the interior, and double-clicked the middle button before the bottom button. The motor engaged, and the lift moved slowly. Liam reached around to the console, but the panel did not release. Liam quickly paused the lift mechanism. He backed it up and tried again. Again, the platform slid toward the door, and again, the hidden panel would not release. With the three guards now standing behind him, staring inquisitively, Liam tried a third time. Same result. He shook his head as he allowed the platform to slide the wheelchair to the door, out of the chassis, and down to the ground.
Yonit, we're going in naked, he said to his belt buckle.
Liam pushed the wheelchair forward and followed Al-Zahani and Kayla into the house. Yusuf handed his rifle to his companion and followed the group into the home. Jack held the briefcase tightly on his lap. The outside of Al-Zahani's home, though large, was commonplace in every sense. White Jerusalem stone, 2 stories, recessed windows. But inside was a sultan's palace. The generous entry hall gleamed in subtle shades of white and caramel travertine. A grand staircase, covered in purple Persian runners, rose regally to the second floor. Al-Zahani led them past the staircase, down the hall, and into a large library with 12-foot ceilings. Several small Persian rugs lay on a floor of beige Italian marble. 2 large palm plants punctuated the corners of a wall of windows that overlooked the gardens.
Where's Sophie? Jack said. She's here, Al-Zahani said. Happy and comfortable. I wish you'd reconsider your insistence that she return to America. Why don't you tell her it's okay to stay here? She is so well integrated into our community, it would be a shame to take her away.
It didn't bother you when you kidnapped her out of Chicago where she was so well integrated in her community, did it?
The doctor shook his head.
I can see that this discussion will lead us nowhere. Just as before, you care more for yourself than your daughter. Still, I wish you would at least consider an accommodation. We would be open to allowing you to visit here any time you wish. You are obviously a man of means. Travel expenses would not seem to be an obstruction. I would even share the expenses with you. Tell Sophie you would like her to live here.
Look, I brought the money.
Where's my daughter? As soon as I see the money, open the case.
Hold on, Jack, Liam said. Simultaneously was the agreement. No Sophie, no money. Al-Zahani shook his head again.
True to your character, Jack, you chose an ill-mannered investigator.
Very well.
The doctor turned to the doorway and called out,
Bashir, would you please bring Sophie to the library?
Jack sat in his wheelchair in the middle of the room, the briefcase on his lap. Kayla stood to his side and slightly behind him. Liam positioned himself a few steps in front as a buffer between Jack and Al-Zahani. Yusuf stood by the doctor's side, a constant grin upon his face. From the opposite corner, Bashir walked into the room, hand in hand with Sophie. Lubana trailed behind.
Daddy!
Sophie shrieked and tried to run to him, but Bashir held her close. He bent down and gently said,
Wait, child. Wait as your daddy has asked. You will have your time.
Al-Zahani wagged a finger.
Remember, Sophie, what we talked about before. We made an agreement. If he chooses and cooperates, your father will meet with you in a few minutes outside. But now, child, I ask you. Do you see his briefcase? Do you remember what I told you?
Sweetheart, Jack interrupted. I love you so much, I'm here to take you home.
I told you!
Sophie shrieked, and wriggled to get loose from the strong grip.
Let me go, Bashir!
Bashir looked to Al-Zahani, who slowly shook his head. Turning his attention to Jack and rolling his fingers in a beckoning gesture, Al-Zahani said,
And now, the case.
Jack focused on the combination lock. His hand shook, first one side, then the other. The clasp clicked and the case opened. The money lay bundled beneath the false explosive device. Kayla placed the case on a table.
Why, Jack? It is mouse-trapped after all.
Booby-trapped, Doc, Liam said. The term is booby-trapped. Now we'll take Sophie and be on our way.
No,
Lubana cried.
You cannot take us, Sophie. You promised me, Arif.
She came up from behind and put her arms around the child.
Be at ease, Lubana, Al-Zahani said. No one will take Sophie. That I do promise you. She will never leave Canaan.
You said I could go home with my daddy. You said!
Cried Sophie. She beat her fists and broke loose from Lubana, but Al-Zahani reached out and grabbed her arm with a strong grip. Jack rose from his wheelchair, took a step forward. His legs buckled and he stumbled. He grimaced from the pain and leaned against his chair.
Let her go, Arif. I've done my part.
Why don't you understand?
Lubana pleaded.
She's safe here. She'll be raised in a loving home with loving grandparents.
Loving grandparents, Kayla said.
Do you know what a murderous monster you're married to? Do you know how many people he's killed and how many more he plans to kill?
Jack steadied himself and started to walk toward Al-Zahani, but Bashir leveled a semi-automatic weapon and shook his head.
Take them outside, Bashir, Al-Zahani said. I have the money. See that they bother us no more. Yusuf, go with them.
There's an automatic weapon in here, Yonit, Liam said loudly. In the library, two guards.
Lubana, Kayla continued. Did he tell you how he killed Alina? Did he tell you he injected her with virulent, deadly bacteria that ate up her organs and caused her to die a beastly, painful death? The same thing that he did to my sister?
What? Jack said.
You did that? You made her sick? You killed Alina?
Arif, Lubana said.
Arif, what she said. Ask him what he's doing out in that laboratory, Kayla said.
Go on, ask him.
Have you ever been out there, Lubana?
It's a madman's laboratory. He's making more poison to kill more people, just like the poison he gave to Alina.
Shut her up, Bashir, snapped Al-Zahani, trying to hold on to Sophie. Take them all outside. Now. But Bashir didn't move. Lubana pulled hard on Al-Zahani's shirt.
Arif, you told me she got an infection, and the American doctors didn't know how to treat her.
She already had that infection when she came home, Jack said. She got that infection here. By the time she got home, it had already caused irreparable damage.
Arif, you could not do that to our daughter.
Tell them.
Jack glared at Al-Zahani.
It's also clear. The doctors couldn't treat Alina because they had never seen that strain before.
It's a biological weapon, and you gave it to her, didn't you? You poisoned her because she wouldn't stay here and be your perfect little—
Shut up! Al-Zahani snapped, taking Sophie by her arm.
Bashir, do your job. Take them outside now. Yusuf, get them out of here!
Bashir held his hand out to stop Yusuf. He stood before Al-Zahani and gave him a hard look.
Saeed, when you treated Alina for her allergies—
Why are you just standing there? Al-Zahani said in a frenetic voice.
How dare you question me? Shoot them or give me the gun!
Bashir was steadfast.
You gave Alina medicine. She told me. An injection for her allergies right before she left Hebron.
He lowered his gun and took a step back.
Kill them, damn you!
Al-Zahani shouted.
Yusuf, take them outside!
but Bashir shook his head and blocked the path.
Daddy!
Screamed Sophie, struggling to free herself from Al-Zahani's grip. She kicked at his legs. She swung her fist.
Daddy! Arif!
Lubani yelled.
Tell me she's lying!
She reached for him. With his free hand, Al-Zahani backhanded his wife and she fell hard to the marble floor.
You stupid woman! Alina left us long before I gave her the injection!
The sounds of shouts and gunshots were heard from the outside. Through the windows, Al-Zahani saw uniformed soldiers running through the courtyard.
It's all over, Doc, Liam said. That's the IDF. You and your plans are finished. Let her go.
Al-Zahani backed up to the bookshelves, his left hand tightly gripping Sophie's arm. He looked around the room at the individuals closing in on him. He looked outside at the dozens of soldiers in the yard.
It's time, Yonit, Liam said loudly.
Al-Zahani's face broke into a demonic smile.
Nothing is over. It's just beginning. You're all too late, you see. The damage is done. Kanan is avenged!
Al-Zahani reached behind him onto one of the shelves and grabbed his black medical bag. He quickly extracted a hypodermic syringe and held the needle up.
Get back now, all of you. This child will stay with me. She is a daughter of Kanan. She will never leave her homeland. I am going to walk to my car with Sophie. Do not interfere or I will inject the child. My granddaughter and I will leave together or we will die together.
He started walking slowly toward the door, his left hand gripped tightly around Sophie's arm, his right hand holding the syringe. Yusef trailed behind him. Sophie screamed,
Daddy!
Yonit, stand down, Liam said, quickly stepping in front of Al-Zahani and blocking his path to the door.
Hold up, Doc, you don't want to do this. You're not going to hurt Sophie. You know you love her and she loves you.
Just let her go and this will all be over.
Do not doubt my resolve. This child is now a soldier in our struggle, and she will be deployed in any way that furthers the cause. My work is critical. I must be allowed to continue my work. I'm going to my car, move out of my way.
I can't do that, Doc. Even if you could make it out the door, you wouldn't get very far.
Then we'll both die, and our blood will mingle with our forefathers in the sands of Canaan. Tell them, Sophie. Say proudly, I am a daughter of Canaan. I won't! I'm not! Let me go!
Sophie twisted, kicked, and pulled at Al-Zahani.
You son of a bitch!
Jack said, and lunged at him. But Al-Zahani quickly stepped to the side as Jack fell to the floor. At that moment, Al-Zahani's focus distracted. Kayla saw her chance. She lashed out, grabbed Al-Zahani's right wrist, and pulled it to the side. Off balance and struggling, Al-Zahani could not restrain Sophie. She broke loose and ran to Jack, who covered her with his body. Yusef pulled a knife from his belt and with a fiendish sneer dashed toward Kayla. Liam flew at him, intercepted him, and tackled him at the knees. Yusef hit the marble floor hard and the knife slid toward the windows. Yusef scrambled to his feet, glanced at the knife, but turned and darted out the front door. Al-Zahani continued to struggle to free himself from Kayla's grip. He slammed her with his elbow, but her hold was tight. Suddenly, his eyes grew wide and he stiffened his back. His breath seized in his throat. Bashir, standing behind, twisted the knife up, then sideways, and pulled it from the doctor's back. Al-Zahani's facial muscles tensed. He tipped forward, then back. As he fell, he windmilled his right arm around, stabbed the syringe into the side of Kayla's neck, and pulled it down hard, opening a gash. She pushed him to the side, and he stumbled and collapsed on the floor, face down. Kayla clawed at the wound and looked at her fingers. A tiny droplet of viscous white liquid was visible in the midst of her blood. Liam grabbed Kayla by the shoulders.
Your neck, that's a bad cut. Did he inject that crap into you?
No. Maybe a little. Doesn't matter, I'm fine. We have to go to the outbuilding. We have to find out what he meant by the damage is done.
Liam grabbed a cotton doily from the table and held it tight against her wound.
I don't like this cut. Keep the pressure on, he said.
They dashed out the door to where Yonit stood in the yard. She was holding an IV bag, embossed with the logo of Sexton International.
This is what they were making. The woman over there told us that 2,000 of these bags, all with the Sexton logo, have been shipped out.
IV bags, Kayla said. They plan to infect patients intravenously.
That's what's in the Jerusalem warehouse. Send the word out to every hospital and clinic in Israel. Tell them not to use Sexton IV sets. Tell them to make immediate arrangements to obtain sets from alternative sources. Do not use Sexton.
Yonit dispatched her lieutenant to make the call. In the library, Jack sat on the floor, his back against the wall, Sophie on his lap. Sophie's face was buried in Jack's chest as he wrapped his arms tightly around her. She shook and cried. Jack smoothed her hair, kissed her on the forehead, and rocked from side to side, their tears commingling.
"I'm so sorry, Sophie," he said between kisses. "I tried so hard to get you. I'm so sorry I failed you, sweetheart. I just want to go home."
Jack nodded and carefully got to his feet. Sophie looked back at her grandmother, sitting on the couch, her face in her hands.
"I have to say goodbye to Jada."
Jack walked her over to Lubana.
"Oh, my child. I'm so sad all this has happened,"
Lubana said as she embraced Sophie.
"Daddy was very troubled. He didn't know what he was doing. The jihadists made him think like that. But he did love you very much. He told me so. Now it's time you go home and be happy with your father."
Jack turned to Al-Zahani, prostrate and lifeless on the floor. He walked slowly to where Al-Zahani lay and stared at the body. A line from Julius Caesar played out in his mind, and he repeated it out loud.
"When could they say, till now, that talked of Rome? That her wide walls encompassed but one man. And like Caesar, Arif, your ambition devoured you. Ambition's debt is paid."
Jack reached down and lifted his daughter.
"Oh, my little butterfly, I missed you so much."
She looked at her grandfather.
"He was going to hurt me."
"No, I don't think he was.
Your grandmother was right. He was very troubled, but he loved you very much, and he would not have hurt you."
"Jadi told me you had gone away without me. But I knew he was lying. I knew you'd never leave me."
Bashir quietly approached the two, bowed, and held out the little stuffed bear.
"It is your sweetness."
He kissed Sophie on the top of her head.
"Goodbye, my little joyous one, so pure of heart. May Allah favor you in all your life's journeys."
In the yard, Yusuf and the other handcuffed prisoners were filing into the IDF vans. A perimeter had been established around the laboratory. Jack walked on unsteady legs from the house into the yard, Sophie beside him. He walked directly to Kayla.
"The syringe is empty,"
he said, holding it for her to see. Kayla pawed at her neck. She looked at the blood-soaked cloth.
"Kayla, listen to me," Jack said. "The doctors told me they would have had a better chance to save Alina if they'd caught the infection early. The problem was she waited too long to get treatment. You need to get to the hospital right away."
"He's right," Liam said. "These soldiers will take you there. I'll be okay. I think it's just a simple cut. He winged me. Most of the solution probably went on my clothes.
Well, we need to get you to the hospital right now, even if it's just a cut. There's a lot of blood," Liam said.
Kayla shook her head.
"This operation's not done. I want Nizar Muhammad, I want Fakir Ali, and most of all, I want that bastard Faiz Talib, alive. My husband and sister demand their justice, and I won't leave without finishing the job."
Yonit flipped her car keys to Liam.
"We'll pick up Fakir and Nizar," she said. "You go get Faiz."
Kayla looked at Liam.
"Come on, Irish. Back me up."
He nodded.
"Okay, you're the boss. Let's go." "You might need this."
Yonit handed Liam a gun.
"Sorry about the guns in the van. It looks like Al-Zahani's guards jammed the mechanism."
"Didn't you hear us?" Liam asked. "What happened to the cavalry?"
She smiled.
"We were listening, but we were kind of busy. Besides, we had confidence in you. And then when you told us to stand down, we figured you had it under control."
A uniformed officer pushed the wheelchair over to Jack and Sophie.
"May I give the two of you a ride back to Tel Aviv?"
"It would be my honor, sir."
Chapter 79.
Liam screeched to a stop in front of Faiz's home and banged on the door. A maidservant met them and immediately backtracked when she saw the gun in Liam's hand.
"Where is Faiz?" Kayla said.
The maidservant slowly pointed to the right. "Ask her how many more servants are inside," Liam said.
"She says no others."
They found Faiz lying on an overstuffed futon when they entered his room. He stroked his wiry beard.
"As they say, money is the root of all evil. We should never have considered the ransom. So, you have come for me. I am informed of the disturbance at the home of Dr. Al-Zahani."
In his right hand he held a 14-inch scimitar. "Get up, you murdering asshole. Drop the knife and put your hands behind your back," Liam said. He shook his head.
"You're too late," he said. "For many things. Too late to stop me from my shahada."
He pulled his tunic up and ran the scimitar along the inside of his leg, slicing his femoral artery. Blood instantly began to pool from beneath his gown an inch across the floor.
"I will die a martyr, and I will no paradise," he said thinly. "You come too late to stop our jihad as well. The bags were delivered to hospitals all over Jerusalem, and are now in use. Hundreds, maybe thousands, are already infected. I have declared to the world the triumphant news that the sons of Canaan are to be given credit for their glorious deeds."
"Look at my face," Kayla snapped, taking the gun from Liam's hand. "Because this is the last thing you will see before you die. A face that curses you. Curses you for Naomi. Curses you for Brian. Curses you for all the innocent people of this land who have their lives tarnished by shit like you. Carry this face into your eternal damnation. You're not a martyr. Your legacy is shame. The likes of you will never stop the promise of peace. You're not even a speed bump." "Let's go," Liam said, taking Kayla by the elbow. "This guy's history." Kayla took a step toward the door, stopped, turned, and pumped 3 rounds into Talib's chest. "Now he is." Liam pointed to her neck. "You're still bleeding. Pretty badly. We need to get you to the hospital." Backing the car away from the curb, he said, "How do I get to Tel Aviv?"
"This is Yonit's car.
We have to bring it back to her. I'm taking you to the hospital.
I'll be fine. I just need a few stitches."
"How do we get to Tel Aviv?" Kayla pointed the way out of town. Her eyes were losing their focus. She blinked several times. Her breathing was shallow. Liam headed west through the town and into the barren West Bank hills. They rode in silence for a while. He looked at Kayla, who seemed to be slipping in and out of consciousness. "Kayla, talk to me."
"I'm not feeling so hot, Liam."
"Stay with me, damn it. Stay alert. I need you to guide me. We'll be there soon."
"You know, he didn't just wing me," Kayla finally said with a catch in her throat. "He didn't miss. I felt the hypodermic needle. I felt him push the plunger. I felt the liquid enter my neck. I knew what had happened, and I knew there would be no reversing it."
"Let's not start the eulogies. When this is all over, I'm taking you for the best steak dinner in Israel. You're going to be okay."
"No, I'm not. I have that poison in me. Just like my sister."
She turned her face toward Liam.
"I'm scared, Liam. It's a horrible death. She suffered so badly."
Liam looked straight ahead. "I said you're going to be okay." He slammed hard on the accelerator.
"But I'm not sorry. It was worth it. We did it, didn't we? We stopped the attack and rid the world of the sons of Canaan. We saved a lot of lives today, Liam."
"You did, Kayla." She started to cry and hid her face in her hands. Liam pulled over onto the shoulder and put his arm around her.
"Oh, Christ, look at that wound."
He took off his shirt, ripped it into strips, and tried to clean the cut and stop the bleeding. "What's Yonit's number?" With a shaking hand, Kayla handed her phone to Liam. "Kayla, listen to me. I'm going to get you to the hospital. We'll be there soon. You heard Jack. The doctors told him they could have saved Alina if they got to her right away. They're going to get to you right away. Stay with me now. Keep the pressure on that cloth."
"It won't matter.
They tried to save Naomi. They tried everything. I've got those bugs in me now. I know they're crawling through my veins. I saw my sister waste away. It was horrible.
Liam pushed the numbers on the cell phone and then spoke to Yonit. I'm on the highway to Tel Aviv, but Kayla's in bad shape. We need help here. She needs a hospital, and I don't know where the hell I'm going.
Where are you?
Highway 35, heading west.
Keep on going and leave the phone on. We'll come to you.
Kayla slumped to the side.
Liam, I'm not feeling too good. I'm real dizzy.
You're going to be okay, I promise. Kayla swallowed hard.
Will you stay with me, Liam? Till the end? I have no one else.
I'm right beside you, Kayla. Liam wove in and out of traffic.
Promise me, please. You won't leave me until the end.
I won't leave you, Kayla. I promise. I'll be right by your side, but I'm telling you, you're going to be all right.
I'm so glad to have met you, Liam. So glad.
And she closed her eyes. Kayla, don't you die on me, goddammit! Liam gunned the BMW. In his rearview mirror, he saw the flashing lights of an IDF paramedic van. He pulled to the side, and Kayla was transferred from the car to the ambulance. Liam followed, and the flashing lights and sirens took them north toward Tel Aviv. Fakir was standing behind the glass counter arranging sweet rolls when he saw two jeeps and a van pull up.
The IDF,
he mumbled. He grabbed the cash out of his register and darted for the back door. The sweat on his palm made it hard to turn the doorknob. He pushed it open and stopped suddenly.
Going somewhere, Fakir?
Yonit said.
I'm going home.
I don't think so. Not now. Not ever.
I have done nothing. The IDF has no right to stop me. This is H1 territory. Let me by.
Al-Zahani's dead.
Unfortunate for Al-Zahani, but it has nothing to do with me. I'm just a simple baker.
Not any longer.
Yonit cuffed him and walked him around to the street.
Who is in charge of delivering the bags?
I will tell you nothing. You'll get no information from me.
She pushed him forward to the paramedic van, where two guards roughly shoved him into a gurney and strapped him down. A paramedic opened a cabinet and extracted a plastic tube, a clamp, and a needle.
Tell me the name of the person who delivered the IVs, Yonit said.
What IVs? I don't know what you're talking about.
Yonit smiled and held up a Sexton IV bag. She turned to the paramedic.
He looks dehydrated to me. I think he needs IV therapy.
The paramedic took the bag from Yonit and set it on the hook. Fakir tilted his head to watch in horror. Sweat poured off his forehead. Large wet circles grew in the armpits of his shirt. He struggled against the straps. The paramedic took the needle and catheter out of the kit and tapped the veins on Fakir's wrist.
No, no, wait, wait! I will tell you! Don't do that, please! I have a wife and children!
Who delivered the IVs?
I think his name is Samuel, but I'm not sure of his address. Somewhere in East Jerusalem.
Not good enough.
She nodded to the paramedic who swabbed Fakir's wrist with alcohol and inserted the needle into his vein.
I want his address, and I want to know how and where he made the deliveries.
Fakir's eyes were fixed on the paramedic. He began to cry.
Oh, stop! Please! Don't connect that back, please! Sammy works for the Mediterranean Company. Mediterranean Medical. That's his job. He's a delivery driver to Jerusalem hospitals. Please, don't give me that solution. It has a horrible disease in it. I don't want to die. You can't do this. It's inhuman.
Where did he deliver the bags?
He took them to the hospitals on his route. The company will know which ones. I don't know. On my mother's grave. I don't know.
When were the deliveries?
Yesterday. The day before.
I want the names and addresses of everyone involved in your godless plot. I want to know where they are right now.
She gave him a pen and paper. Fakir was crying convulsively. His hand shook so badly, he could barely hold the pen. The central intercom of Jerusalem Memorial broadcast an emergency message. All Sexton IVs were immediately to be taken out of use. Any patients receiving IV treatment with any Sexton product within the past 2 days were to be identified and contacted. In the moments after Mediterranean Medical Supply called each of the hospitals on Sami's route, the Sexton IV bags were segregated. Substitute IV sets were rushed from other hospitals.
Calls went out to alternative medical supply companies in several countries.
Okay, Mr. Kelson, we're going on the record. Assistant U.S. Attorney Thomas Tryon sat opposite Victor Kelson and his lawyer in the small government conference room. A 10-page statement lay on the table in front of Kelson. A video camera was recording the event. Please identify yourself. Kelson nodded.
My name is Victor Wallace Kelson. Purpose of this meeting is to place your signed statement into the record. Is that right, Mr. Kelson?
Yeah.
And to make a deal for a reduced sentence. As we've explained to you, the Justice Department can only make recommendations to the court. The judge will determine your sentence after you plead guilty and your pre-sentence investigation is finished.
Kelson looked at his lawyer.
But we've made a deal for 12 years with a chance I could get out in 10. Right, Marty?
The lawyer nodded.
That will be our office's recommendation, Tryon said. But as we've explained to you at least 3 times, there are no guarantees on your sentence. The judge can disregard the recommendation. Please affirm you understand that.
Yeah, I understand. No guarantees. And you'll put me in some minimum security prison under a false identity so that those fucking Russians won't know where to find me, right? I mean, that's the deal.
Tryon nodded and patted the statement. Again, that will be our recommendation. You need to sign and identify your statement.
And my wife. Can you put her in witness protection somewhere?
We'll see.
Tryon tapped the paper.
Please read and sign your statement.
Kelson read the 10-page statement into the record.
Have you fully and accurately supplied the information about Dmitry Borsinov and his involvement in the scheme to kidnap the Summers child and embezzle the escrow money?
Kelson nodded.
It was all his idea. But you willingly participated?
Kelson nodded.
Yeah. Should never let him into the basketball payoffs. That was my big mistake. Wish I never met him or his goon Yevgeny.
Have you fully and accurately set forth the details of your sports bribery scheme?
Yeah, it's all there. All 11 years.
Finally, you understand it is your obligation to testify in accordance with this statement at the trials of Borsinov, Karasov, and Perushkin. If you refuse to testify or testify falsely, this plea agreement will be voided and you will additionally be prosecuted for perjury. You understand all that?
Kelson nodded.
Do you affirm that the statement you just read is true and correct?
He nodded.
Yeah, and made voluntarily with no threats or coercion.
Yeah.
Sign your statement.
Kelson flipped to the last page and signed his name.
Okay, this recording is completed. Take him away.
2 days later, on a blistering hot afternoon, just east of Eilat at the Yitzhak Rabin border crossing, several travelers stood patiently in line with their passports. One such man in traditional white desert garb, an ankle-length thobe, and a full white keffiyeh held in place by a golden-braided igal, anxiously awaited his turn to present his documents and enter Jordan. A woman's voice called his attention from behind.
Hebron no longer suits you, Nizar?
He spun around to see a woman and 2 men in IDF uniforms.
Yonit beckoned him with her index finger.
This way, please.
Nizar bolted out of line and ran toward the sea. He was quickly apprehended, but appeared to be choking. He collapsed and died in the arms of an IDF soldier.
Chapter 80 Liam stared at his buzzing phone. The text message read, "Please call me."
"Hey, Kat, what's up?" Liam said. "Been 4 days since the rescue, and I just wanted to know when you're coming home. I'm missing you." "I miss you too." "I'm not sleeping well since that incident with Kelson. I wake up, I leave the light on. I need you to come home." "I know, I'm sorry, but I can't leave Israel just yet." "Why not?" "Because I made a promise." "A promise? What does that mean? I thought the operation was finished. When are you coming home?"
Liam heard the tension in her voice.
"I'm not sure. I'm not sure when I can leave." "What do you mean you're not sure?"
"What's going on, Liam?"
"I made a promise. It's Kayla, isn't it? That's why you can't leave.
Yes.
Damn you, Liam.
The line went dead. He called her. He redialed her, but she wouldn't pick up. Finally, he texted, "I think Kayla's dying." A few minutes later, his phone rang.
"I'm sorry," Catherine said softly.
"I thought my fault. I should have explained. You remember, I told you that Kayla suffered a bad injury at the compound and Al-Zahani managed to inject that poison into her. What I haven't told you is that the doctors have been unable to stop the disease. Even though we took her straight to the hospital, it didn't matter. They'd never seen anything like it, and they didn't know how to treat it. Now they tell me they're trying a new antibiotic, but so far she's real sick. She can't eat, she's lost a lot of weight. Cat, she looks terrible." He paused. "She doesn't have any family. She doesn't have anyone. I promised her I would stay."
"I'm so sorry, Liam. You should stay. Shame on me.
Listen, Kat, I miss you a lot. There's a United flight out of Newark at 10:50 tonight. What do you say?
You want me to come to Israel? Just drop everything?"
"Yes, I do. More than anything."
"I don't know. Please."
Pause.
"I'll try. I have an appointment at the U.S. Attorney's office later this morning. I'll see what I can do."
Liam checked the arrival board for the 100th time. Catherine's flight was delayed yet again. Rain in Newark. Damn the rain. Does anyone ever get out of Newark on time? He sat at a table in the arrival hall, drinking his fourth cup of coffee, watching as passengers wheeled their luggage through the customs doors to meet their friends and family. He fidgeted. This was to be a big moment, he hoped. Finally, Catherine walked into the lobby. Liam smiled broadly, rushed up, and hugged her tightly, lifting her off the floor.
"My goodness, Liam."
Liam looked around the busy hall, turning his head in every direction, surveying the crowded terminal in consternation.
"Is something wrong? What are you looking for?"
"Nothing." He took her by the elbow and led her to an area near the coffee shop. He took a deep breath. "Excuse me," he said nervously to a couple standing nearby. "I need a little room here." The couple backed up. Liam dropped to his knee and held out the open jewelry box.
"Oh my God," Catherine said. "Are you crazy?"
"Kat, I'm sorry the setting isn't more romantic, but I can't chance another interruption."
"Oh my God." The crowd of passengers began to form a circle.
"I want to see this," a woman said as she yanked at her husband's sleeve and pulled him over to the front of the gathering.
"Kat, there's only you. All my life, there's only you. It's high tide, sweetheart. Will you marry me?" "Oh yes, I will.
You bet I will."
She wrapped her arms around him, and the welcome hall of Ben Gurion International Airport broke into cheers and applause. Chapter 81. As the sun rises over the spires of Jerusalem's old city, a man in a black suit, the fringes of his white tallit showing beneath his jacket's hem, like a slip beneath a skirt, walks through Jerusalem's Jewish quarter to say his morning prayers at the Kotel, the Western Wall. He walks sprightly, proudly, with his two young sons. Hundreds of others are already praying there. No matter the time of day, prayers are offered to God at the wall of Herod's citadel. Above, on the mountain of the house of God, is the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Beneath the dome lies the foundation stone, the holiest site of the Jewish religion, upon which the Ark of the Covenant was placed in the first temple. Directly to the west, in the Christian quarter of the old city, Catholic Mass, served in Latin, is beginning in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The church stands directly upon the Hill of Calvary, where Jesus Christ was crucified, anointed, and laid to rest in the limestone cave donated by Joseph of Arimathea. The small edicule in the center of the rotunda embraces the tomb. A line has already begun to form,
and worshippers wait their turn to pray in the edicule. The church is Christendom's most holy site, a place of pilgrimage, the site of the resurrection. In the Muslim quarter, a man passes through a guarded gate and walks up the ramp to the Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary on the Temple Mount. The Dome of the Rock, the golden shrine completed in the year 691 to cover the foundation stone and the place where David and Solomon had planned their temple, is open for him to enter and pray. Across the square is the silver-domed Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest site, where the Prophet Muhammad was transported from Mecca during his night journey, and from where he ascended to heaven. From a small room inside the mosque, a man chants the Adhan into a microphone, and the Arabic call to prayer is heard throughout the old city. Throughout the narrow walkways of the four quarters, shopkeepers begin to unlock their doors and unfold their awnings. They sweep the stone sidewalks and lay out displays of their colorful wares. Even old Abu Hamad will soon shuffle up to his door, open his antiquities store, and wait to have a cup of tea with a curious visitor. Jerusalem is waking up, coming alive. The streets will soon be filled with tourists, shoppers, worshippers, pilgrims. Another glorious day begins in this troubled land, safe and secure from the threats of yesterday, on guard for today. 55 kilometers to the west, on the 6th floor of Tel Aviv Medical Center, a group is gathered.
Another hospital room? Another enclave? Marcy says, pouring a glass of water into a tumbler.
Jack sits by the foot of the hospital bed near Sophie, who is perched at a little desk with a coloring book, Sweetness on her lap. A McDonald's hamburger and shake sit on the corner of the desk.
Thank you,
Kayla says, accepting the water with both hands. She lays propped up on her bed, hooked up to patient monitors, with antibiotics dripping into her veins. Suddenly the door opens and Catherine and Liam enter the room. Marcy smiles.
How was your flight?
Long and tiring, but well worth it. Liam told me he's not leaving until Kayla gets better, so here I am. Catherine the World Traveler. I can't leave my man alone with a gorgeous spy. Kayla looks at Liam.
Did you do it?
She whispers. He nods. He blushes.
Let me see the ring,
Kayla says with a broad smile. Catherine holds out her hand. Kayla and Marcy examine the diamond closely and give their enthusiastic approvals.
Mazel tov,
Kayla says.
Tell me, did you do it with pomp and circumstance?
Oh, did he ever, Catherine answers. He got down on his knee in the middle of the airport. Everyone was watching.
Way to go, Irish,
Kayla says with a wink. Catherine stares at the video monitors.
So, how's our gorgeous spy doing? Not feeling so gorgeous right now. They're working on me,
she says with a shrug. Her complexion has lost a shade or two.
Tell me it's a real nasty bug. But they think this new antibiotic is doing the trick. I'll have to stay here for a while until my blood work comes back clean, but they're optimistic.
You're looking much better today, Liam says. Kayla nods.
I'm feeling better. I think the medicine's working. I even had some breakfast. You're an amazing woman, Catherine says. You saved a lot of lives and rescued a very sweet little girl.
Kayla smiles and reaches out for Catherine's hand.
Thanks, but I had a lot of help. Sadly, there were fatalities. The IDF didn't recover all the bags in time. Some patients received the IV solution before the hospitals were alerted. News reports warning of possible infections were broadcast on every channel and every paper. But some folks are remote and won't hear. They probably won't know how to get treatment. Some are Bedouins who have returned to their simple lives in the desert. They weren't even targets of the terrorists.
And the sons of Canaan?
Like Canaan, they are no more, Kayla says. 7 of them were taken alive and they will spend their lives in prison.
Nizar Muhammad took his own life at the Jordanian border crossing. Ironically, he poisoned himself. Fakir Ali gave Yonit all the details of the operation. Everyone involved, every location. He even provided the address of the cold storage warehouse, where we discovered the boxes of Sexton IVs that were switched out for the poison. The IDF destroyed Al-Zahani's laboratory, and all vestiges of the deadly bacteria. Israel incinerated thousands of IV sets. In the hospital storage rooms, it was impossible to tell the originals from the fakes, so they had to destroy them all. Several nations shipped replacements. Now, tell us the news from Chicago. A little birdie told me you have good news.
A little birdie from the State Department?
Catherine looks at Jack and then at Sophie, who smiles and continues coloring pictures on her papers, many of which have been taped to the walls of the hospital room.
Jack, I met with the U.S. attorney right before I left Chicago.
It was through your cooperation that a point-shaving ring was busted, murderers were arrested, embezzled money was recovered, and an international kidnapping was resolved. A major coup for the Chicago office. Kelson, Dmitri, and Yevgeny are all in custody thanks to you. Kelson and Dmitri face a number of federal charges stemming from the embezzlement and sports bribery. Dmitri and Yevgeny are additionally charged with 3 counts of murder. Yuri Perushkin is charged with attempted murder and will await trial in Hawaii. The escrow money has been recovered and placed in a government account pending forfeiture proceedings. But most significantly, because of Kelson's involvement, there is no longer a victim of the embezzlement, nor any reason for a court to vindicate the interests of Kelson Manufacturing. The lawsuit against Jenkins and Fairchild has been dropped. Walter's so happy he paid for my airline ticket. All of Kelson's and Dimitri's assets were seized as fruits of a criminal enterprise. The government took their cars, their money, their homes, even Dimitri's wife's jewelry. Everything. Boy, is she pissed. If she could, she'd personally administer the death penalty. And then the strangest thing. I don't know how this happened. Catherine winks at Kayla. But the Israeli government has made a strong request through diplomatic channels. Jack is credited with helping to foil a major terrorist attack. I dare say he's an international hero. I understand the president himself wants to thank you, Jack. All in all, you will not be prosecuted. Jack turns his head to blot a tear. Sophie and I thank you all so much. You saved our lives.
The gratitude is all ours, Kayla says. Are we going to our home in Chicago soon? Sophie asks.
Maybe for a while, Jack responds. Would you like to go to Hawaii? Maybe even live there someday? He glances at Marcy. Sophie's eyes widen.
Is that where they do the hula hula dance?
You better believe it, Marcy says.
Then I would.
Sophie smiles and says,
Can Jamila come and play at our house in Hawaii?
Who is Jamila? Jack asks.
She's my very best friend in Hebron.
The room is silent for a moment.
The answer is yes, Sophie, Liam interjects. Definitely yes.
I have come to believe on good authority that it will happen someday. Jamila will come to your house and you will go to hers. Not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday. Maybe when your generation is in charge. And you know why it will happen? Because there are more people like Kayla than there are bad people. And because sooner or later, good people who deserve peace will stop listening to bad people.
Jack put his arm around Sophie.
He's right. Good people like you and your mother, who have the courage to accept people and love them for who they are, no matter what they're told by others. Racism will never win out. It's flawed in every sense because love is much stronger than hate.
Kayla smiles proudly.
Seems you are surrounded by your disciples, Liam says to her.
My Last Supper?
Kayla looks at her tray of jello and fruit juice.
Not so fast, Irish. You're not getting out of it so easy. I intend to collect on that steak dinner.
This is Fred Berman. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Saving Sophie by Ronald H. Balson. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2015 by Ronald H. Balson. Production copyright 2015 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.